Accession number 12713, Mr. Tony Temple, Reel 10.
Mr. T. Temple, Reel 10. This prisoner, who'd obviously got away from his main unit and had escaped on a number of occasions, was there at that time any form of battle line police or who would be behind a front line situation to turn people back, as there had been in the First World War, for example?
Not that sort of situation, Harry, at least not to my knowledge. There were military police at the rear of the battlefield, but these were primarily to direct traffic wherever you may be. In the desert, of course, we needed these sort of people too, because there were so many tracks leading off a main track or crossing a road, and at these junctions you would always find MPs there. In order to keep the flow of traffic going so there wouldn't be any snarls up, and to give general directions where they wanted to be, why they wanted to be, who your identification was, whatever. They knew the job fairly well, but there wasn't anybody specifically behind us to stop anybody running. And this was the only man, to my knowledge, that ever ran away from the battalion.
Did you know why? What had set him away?
No, because we hadn't. The only contact we had with him was transferring from Geneva back to the battalion in Aleppo, in the Lebanon. And this sergeant, who he didn't trust him, we had a railway carriage to ourselves. This was a peculiar travel, really, because we left Geneva, went up the canal by to the nearest railhead, was Ismailia, on the way to El Cantara up the canal, where we crossed over the canal and then went into through Jordan that way on. And I think we had two changes of railway. The very top one was when we had gotten the Lebanon, which was a very narrow gauge. And we constantly had this blow. I mean, let's face it, this sergeant just shackled his feet and his hands together. He wasn't going to get away. No way. There was no question of us nodding up. If you wanted to go to the toilet, one of us had to go in there with him. Or if the toilet was on the station, two of us went with him. There was no way he was going to get away from this blow. And we eventually finished up in again back to the channel, and we just handed him over and said, right, you're in the guard room now. That was their problem. We had got him back. And this was after the campaign had finished, of course, during the course of my illness, and they retrained him back in Geneva. And pending could return to the regiment, the campaign had finished, and the battalion was stationed in Aleppo, and this is where we took this lad to.
The purpose to get him back was to try him?
The purpose was to give him a court-martial. He'd been notified that he was under court-martial on his first case with the battalion. But and every time he would try to be rolled back to the battalion for trial, he was always escaping. Well, he couldn't be tried by any other unit, because no other unit knew anything about it. There was only the first Durhams knew anything about it, and he had to be transferred. And every time they made the attempt, four, five, six times he got away. Either out of the guard room, out of a bush, out of a car. But he got away, he was determined. But this guy got him back, or at least three of us got him back, and he was sent for trial. He got 7 years.
Do you recall his name?
I can't, Harry, I can't really. I would be forced to even try to remember so far back. And these are the sort of incidents, in any case, you like to put behind you, because it was a blot on the battalion. One man sent back, to cowardice in the face of the enemy. It's peculiar.
So you were on the Turkish frontier, I think you said.
Yeah,
coming through. Yeah. What happened next?
Well, we were, there's quite some time, really. We spent a lot of time there going into town, and we were joined then by, as I was said, explained before, when you're in these places, you seem to think, you're here for a stay, like a long rest. You're not, you're training the whole time. And with this war was reaching a stage where we're going to have to move at some stage or other. So we started training, mountain warfare, invasion. We'll go out to sea or in the boats and start approaching the coast for invasion purposes. And we were joined by the 7th and 11th Gurkhas. We were in the Gurkha Brigade then. And they taught us a little bit about mountain warfare, how it should be carried out. And my God, So they were the boys from Mountain Warfare. They gave us a number of demonstrations, and we were given one, a special one, being stretcher bearers. And how would you get a man down the mountainside? We went the usual thing, like, put him on your stretcher, two of you, struggle down. I said, any other way? He said, yeah, just watch this. And of course, this little girl picked up this 5'11" bloke on his shoulders. He went down the mountainside like a goat. No, but a quarter of the time that we took to get out of the regimental aid post. They were smashing guys, and this recalls a scheme that was on at the time, that we were going to be in the invading force, and the Gurkhas were going to be the defenders, and we would land on the beaches, battalion land on the beaches, and go forward, and up towards the foothills, and then into the mountains, and it was really quite a slog, you know, and in the summer, it really gets hot, you got your equipment on the back, and it really gets tough, you're climbing the whole time. And we were as thin as rakes, but really fit. And on the way up through the mountains, we were passing through these villages, trying to find a girl, because you couldn't find a bloody man anyway. You know, they were hiding all over the place. And funnily enough, they used to take this as serious. You know, it was not to get a bat on the head and knock you out and say, oh, you're our prisoner now. And that was it. Away you would go. You were their prisoner. And they hung on to you till the end of the day. But we were going up through these villages, and a lot of the lads says, well, tapping on the little houses that we had up there, sheep herders and goat herders, you know, mainly. Can we have a drink? We're making all the signs for a drink. Oh, yeah, don't bother. And they would go into the house and come back with this lovely, clear liquid. How do you taste it? Beautiful, like aniseed. Beautiful. So at last, tap on the shoulder again. Listen, that's just some orders. Before the day was finished, the regiment was tight on this zimmy. It was a liquor. And it was like what they called aniseed. Made out of aniseed, and it was pure liquor. When you emptied poured water into it to dilute it, it was turning like a colour of milk with the blokes thinking, it was just milk, and it was really, really nice stuff. They called the exercise off because we couldn't do it. It was really funny that, but these guys were good fellas.
Exercising like that in mountains and so forth, did this set off any rumours or discussions or ideas as to where you might be going next?
No, you were quite happy, you know, just where you were at the time. And suddenly we were told that we were on a move, we were going back to a camp in Alexandra. Oh, I said, oh, fair enough. And where we got to on the transport from there to the, mainly by trucks, motor transport, because the rear was out of the question. As I said, he had about two changes of route where you couldn't do this with a battalion with all its equipment. So we used to go by road. When the battalion was on its move on its own, a smaller outfit like a platoon possibly, or a couple of sections or individuals, possibly by train, but certainly not a battalion on the move. It would always have to be motorised transport. The carriers, of course, they would just follow along with the transport. They were never put on tank carriers or anything like that. They flogged along with us. And we finished up in Alexandra. It took us two or three days to get there. And this is where the MPs were. Not the only time we really had some MPs. We went into this camp. The transports left. And these gates were sealed up. And we noticed that blokes were patrolling out on the outside. We said, what the hell's going on here? We thought it was under some sort of punishment, you know. And the CO got us all together. He said, no. He said, we're here. He said, we're until we're transported somewhere else at the moment. It's a secret. I'm sorry, I can't tell you any more. Obviously, he had to tell us something. He said, but even I don't know. Which we knew it to be a lie, because we obviously wouldn't know where we were going. And, of course, one thing, you lead thoughts, and you weren't in contact with any, except these guys on the outside of the perimeter of the camp. And they weren't letting on. Possibly they don't know. They might have been shipped from any place in the world from there. But we were putting two and two together. We were having radios, and we listened to radios, and the Prime Minister of Australia saying this, and the Prime Minister of New Zealand is saying that. And we put two and two together and say, hey, this is a relief job at the Brook. And so it transpired. We woke up one morning and said, right, you're on your way. And we went to the docks at Alexandra, and we boarded naval vessels, destroyers. Nothing bigger than that, just destroyers. I think there must have been about eight of us. I was on the Kipling. And I remember when we got out to sea, pushed over, we were helping with defence with those small arms that we did have, you know, in case of bomber attack or fighter attack. Machine guns positioned at various points where the commander of the ship said we had to position them. And we were stretching there, we were just mumping about the top deck. And lunchtime, you open your tin of bully in your heart, talking, you know, having a feed, as it were. This lad tapped me on the shoulder. I said, "Hey, what can I do for you?" He said, "No, don't know who I am." I said, "No." He said, "Studolph?" I said, "Studolph? Oh," I said, "Aye, if you lived in Peel Street." "I lived in South Shields, in Peel Street." He says, "Aye." He said, "Well, I've arranged with the lads to come down to the mess, so you can come down to the mess deck and have a meal with us instead of the rubbish that you're getting knocked up." And so I went down to the mess deck, and I had, they shared their food up, because apparently they have a mess deck, and they're divided up in whatever watches that they are on. And they get their own food from the galley, and I was shared with it. They had a guest for that meal. And so we went into Tobruk, which is highly nerve-wracking, because we weren't, funnily enough, attacked at sea.
Was this a daylight journey?
Oh, yeah. It started as daylight journey. I mean, they practically hugging the coast. The coast was out of sight. We couldn't see anything. Virtually speaking, we still hadn't been told where we were going. We were just on these destroyers heading out to sea. But we had an idea. And it was at night time when we arrived in Tobruk. And the destroyers were just cruising in very, very slowly to pull in alongside a ship that had been sunk, you know. And this is how we made our way ashore with all our equipment.
What were your first impressions of Tobruk?
Very poor, because it was in the middle of the night for one thing, you know.
Was there any activity going on?
Yeah, the usual shelling was going on at the various fronts. The odd shells or two were belting in the harbour. No aircraft at the time. Lots of shellfire going up along the front with small arms, which you could hear permanently. It didn't matter which part of the perimeter you were in, you could always hear this. We got off a comparatively light. There was very little shell in that wind when we disembarked. As I said, we were disembarking not on the moors or the dock side. We were going across all the ships that had been sunk in the harbour and going across that way. And the Navy were trying to shivvy us along, you know, get out of critical condition. They wanted to be out, because they were on a time run as well. So they shipped us out, and we went the way we went. A guide was there to meet us, an Australian bloke. He led us to the salient on the roughest part of Tobruk, on the salient where we were just 200 yards apart.
And you moved straight in there, did you?
Yeah, oh yeah, straight in. We'd leave the 2nd 43rd Battalion at night. You moved at night. We only moved ever once during the day in Tobruk. This is one reflection I've got on the whoever issued this command. Must have been some sort of an idiot. But the initial stage is going in. It was all under cover of darkness. The Germans had never set any flares up or anything, so they mustn't have known very much about it. Unless somebody hadn't been contacted and told them there was no reinforcements going on, or unless they didn't even know the reinforcements were going on. It was only the occasional shell that dropped in the harbour, as it were, one every, you know, 2 or 3 minutes. Fairly hefty guns, mind. Well, 155mm, I suppose.
Did you see much sign of the havoc and
what was out? The sign of havoc had it. You couldn't see a building standing. There was just nothing there. I mean, the HQ of the defensive forces was in the town itself. They must have been in a bunker somewhere right under it, because it was total devastation, absolute total devastation. Remember that the Aussies had been in there almost 9 months, and had held it for 9 months. So you know there's terrific amount of devastation in there. Now, I don't suppose there was one or two bricks standing on each other. You could see heaps of rubble where, you know, buildings had collapsed in or been blown out of or whatever it was, but there was no such uniformity as this building there or that wall's there. Nothing like that. Shell holes all over the place. It was complete devastation. No question about that.
Did you get any opportunity to speak to any of the Australians who were coming out as you were going in?
Well, we spoke to quite a number of them, because actually they stayed there till we got there. And I was taken over from the stretcher bearer from the 2nd 43rd Australian Infantry. And he was telling us a bit about what was going on. I had a special dugout of shells, you know, with again the two of us with a couple of spare bunks. Because the situation, as we found out, it was very rare that you could take a casualty during the course of the day. I mean, you're only 200 yards apart. They held the high ground where the snipers were in evidence, and the situation was that nearly everything was done at night. Even going to the toilet, you didn't go out during the course of the day. We were so close to each other. The only thing that I think that was ever regimented between the two sides, which was not verbally arranged or arranged in any way at all, was the cookhouse of a morning. As I've explained to you before, when we had these petrol burners were on long stands to where your Dixie's on the top, like you fill them whatever you've got water and so forth, and heat it up. And we used to take it in turns that we would light up first one morning and they would light up first the next morning. But there was never a shot fired during that period of breakfast. And that was perhaps for about an hour and a half. Let them have the breakfast and the smoke, as it were, you know. And then you'd back to your dugout again, and we'd start knocking the hell out of each other again.
You've mentioned breakfast, Mr. Temple. Can you take me through the kind of meals you were getting in the course of a day, and how the food was getting to you, and how it was being cooked, etc.? So for breakfast, what would you be likely to have?
Well, breakfast usually involved, as I think I've mentioned it before, of these tins of bacon. Again, bacon and beans. Tin sausage and beans, which was the more or less staple breakfast. Again, we had no bread. It was a question of hardtack, again, biscuits. Water, which had to be conserved quite. We used to get well supplied with water, but you still had to take care of it. It was all supplies were done at night. You couldn't possibly do anything during the day at all. So that your meals were hodgepodge, in the sense that you could only grab a meal where you could. In some cases, it was a cold meal. You maybe open a tin of beans and just have them out on a spoon, cold meal. It was only probably at night time again where you dare put a little bit fire or a small burner that you had in your trench or your dugout, whatever it was you were in, which were covered over, and so you heat yourself up a cup of tea or something like that. You know, water out your water bottle would be used for that, and you would refill it again from the usual supplies. But meals were so you couldn't regulate and say, well, this is the sort of menu or this is the sort of time that you get your meals, because there was only the one meal that you really got, which you really enjoyed and had plenty of time to eat, was your breakfast, which was agreed between both sides without talking to each other, because they were in the same position what we were, because whilst we were in a defensive position, our 25 pounders were still knocking hell out of their trenches, and it was going backwards and forwards the whole time, machine gun fire, rifle fire, snipering. So this breakfast break, as it were, that we had between us, was an unwritten law, and I think both sides really appreciated this time. But other meals, well, it just had to be taken. You could sometimes risk getting the burner, so during the course of the day, putting them in some sort of a slit trench and doing that sort of thing. But then again, once being served, you had what, in a company, you had three platoons, and we also with us had a mortar platoon. You would only have to fend these blokes out a section at a time. And say, well, come and get it, give us your mess tins and get over here back, like, as soon as you could. Because as soon as you made a move out of those trenches, the German snipers would be after you.
These burners you're talking about, just small individual things of your own, or between two or three men, whatever?
Well, these were supplied for a company. They're fairly big. They were built in sections. Each section used to fit into the other, a normal push section you push in. About a foot high by about 18 inches long. And about a foot wide. The sides were enclosed completely with a plate at the back, so that anything that came from the petrol burner was entirely enclosed with the Dixie on the top and the sides closed in the far end. So you could virtually say, well, you could extend it to as far as you like, but the only snag was that the burners were limited to how far they could go out. So they could probably go out about 3 or 4 yards, but you weren't getting any heat, so we used to close them down to about 3. And then very, this is all we had with it. You were doing one for tea, one for your beans, and one for your bacon, or sausage, whatever it was. And meal times, it was tinned vegetables, potatoes, McConaughey soups, stews. Very limited diet, very limited. No such thing as fresh food or fresh eggs, anything. This was, I should have mentioned this in Syria, it was quite different. This a mixture of menus that we had in Syria was the fact that we basically, wherever you were in the Middle East, this was the sort of food that you got there, that we used what we all call, always called hardtack, which is always out of a tin or out of a packet of some sort. But during the course of the Syrian campaign, or with us, it was the Lebanese campaign, we used to come into contact with the local natives who were always keen to do a trade, to buy a bit of barter for different things. And they took a shine to our petrol cans, which were supplied by the service corps, the people who was, the regiment who supplies us with all sorts of things. And they were big, shiny tankers, about hold 10 gallon. And the peasants, they were quite taken by these shiny cans. And the barton used to get between us. We said, well, what can you give with this? They said, oh, we give you eggs. So we said, right, or we took the top off one, and we sent this bloke back with it, and he said, you fill it with eggs, we give you a can. So he came back with this can full. I mean, there must have been a couple of hundred bloody eggs in it. And we said, well, how many do you want? He said, just one. He held his finger up, just one. So we give him three or four. Said, oh. And we're quite chuffed with these shiny cans, what they used to use for all sorts of things. It eventually evolved that we were getting fresh fruit, the same thing, grapes, filling these cans, and it could come get two more cans and that. They were always insisting that we took the top off for them, because they couldn't take the top off cleanly, not with their stuff, and we used to take ours off fairly cleanly. And this is how we got the fresh stuff when we were doing a campaign in Syria. All sorts of citrus fruits, grapes, and all sorts of figs. Great stuff. It had a great variety to the diet, but in Tobruk, or elsewhere in the desert, the diet was very, very stable. Very, very stable. And it was always the same thing. To the boredom of point, really. But you couldn't do anything about it. Nobody could do anything about it. I mean, the Navy were doing their best to fetch up supplies, but they couldn't take up, you know, precious space on ships with fresh eggs and bread or whatever. So we were stuck with this particular diet. And this is how we lived during the course of the whole siege. And as I say, we fought this battle with the Germans on the salient with this recognised break for four meal times. But this was just as we could and where and when.
Did supplies come up to you at night, and what you were eating, was that coming from behind you and coming into you at night?
Yes, they had to, Harry. There were 1,500 transport. A small truck would come up and dump the supplies and get off as soon as he could. And he would drop them for the whole company. He wouldn't go around the three platoons we had and the mortar section. He would just drop them off at the company headquarters where the CSM and the company commander were, and they would issue them out from there. It was possible to go to company HQ during the course of the day if you were fairly quick to collect some sort of thing, but you couldn't carry very much. You couldn't stop out too late. You had these German snipers who were pretty good. It was every time that they saw anything move, they would have a go at. So, you know, you took your life in your own hands. Even the eventualities of going to the toilet, it was, I suppose, we used to want to go out and have a spade with it. Possibly the sniper who was very close to you knew where you were going, so he wasn't going to bother with you at all. And he would go up the company lines and dig a hole there, hopping in between mines, of course. And taking a risk on that, digging it, which they insisted on for hygiene purposes. This is what you had to do, then cover it over and then come back. And I suppose all blokes were doing the same for them. So if you wanted a crap, you just waved your shovel and away you went.
So you didn't have a community toilet? Literally.
No. One officer decided, a young chap who'd joined us, so he hadn't seen any action at all. But he would have this Hessian place. I wasn't involved in this. I was at company HQ, but he was one of the platoon commanders. And he would have this wonderful little Hessian toilet with a properly made seat, and lads made it funny. He would have it put there, dig the trench for him. And they'd done this, and fortunately, there was no fire from the snipers, because they must have thought, well, what the hell's going on here? Obviously in clear view. And they just let them get on with it. He must have tumbled to the fact that somebody was building a toilet. When it was finished, of course, the lieutenant says, thank you very much, I'll use the toilet. And we went to the toilet, and this is when the sniper started moving. He dropped the bullet right between his feet. That bloke, he must have shit himself on his way out, sorry. But he must have done, because as he jumped up and his trousers were around his ankle, can you imagine trying to blow it? He didn't know whether to shuffle, run, hop, jump, stop for his trousers, and every move he made, the jelly was just dropping the bullet behind him. He must have had some hilarious fun with that bloke, man. He finally dived in the trench, but he wants to thank his lucky stars. That toilet was pulled down the next the same night the same night as Will. He never got a comfortable crap to eat.
What was the washing situation like?
Where you could and whenever you could. Very little, Harry. Very little. Where you couldn't, as again, if you were doing any washing. The water supplies were fairly good. They must have been getting from the town some artesian wells or something, but certainly we had nothing in the front line, no wells of any sort. The water came up, but it was washing. You didn't have any much time for it because, as I say, you no sooner asleep than you were away again. As face facts, you know, a good dark run about 7 o'clock, depending on the time of year. And you stood to for a couple of hours after that. And then you were up again at, say, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, standing to prior 2 hours before daylight. And if there was any sort of scare at all, any movement or any sound, that used to wake everybody up again, just in case there was something happening. So he never used to get much sleep. So it was evident he didn't have much time for washing. Done what we could, where we could and when we could.
What were your activities? Obviously, it was only at night time that you could really move around, so presumably at night you were most active.
Yeah, well, this is when we used to go.
What kind of activities were you up to?
Well, the rum ration was the best one. We used to get a daily ration of rum, but this was served at night, served up by the company sergeant, Major Feet Nicholson. And he used to issue the rum rations, and he went down as a section, and he noted he'd be man in the section, give him his rum ration, the way they went back again. And Bully Noble and I sat in lay down in the way he could sit up in this little dugout that we had. And we heard this sound, this glug, 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 glug. So what the hell is that? We poked our heads out then, and we crept up the old Feet Nicholson's tent, and there he was. We could see through the crack in the tent that he had a huge pot, and he was pouring this rum out for himself and swigging it. He must have been as tight as a bloody noodle after half an hour. This was the sort of thing that went on. We never got the chance to do this, of course. You were just given this rum ration. And mine, I never used to drink it because I hated the damn stuff. I used to give it to my mate, Billy Noble. He used to get it. Well, that was the highlight of the day, is having your rum ration. More like the nearly rums up, but they were quite comfortable with it. But the lads used to take a sip of rum every night. Very rarely was it kept.
Did it become common knowledge that this NCO was drinking?
Oh, yeah. Feet with the lads will say, "How feet have you had your rations this week?" Or tonight, he was a crafty old bugger, but everybody knew. They didn't take any too much notice of it. They didn't say, well, they were in the same position, they would probably do the same themselves, you know. One of the two of the mourners got to throw a belt up, you know. Wouldn't nobody bother here.
So through the evening, you could sleep during the dark?
During the dark. Well, it was policy too, wasn't it? As soon as it was dark, nothing. Well, you see, you've got to bear in mind again that they used to get the occasional star shell up. If there was any movement, then they would start with the barrage again. It could start at any time, and let's face it, you couldn't do anything during a barrage of shells. And there were some hefty shells used to come across, as well as the small arm stuff, the mortars. I say 110 millimeters, 155 millimeters, good shells. They were fairly hefty pieces of equipment.
Living in effect a hole in the ground, did you have any problem with lice or little creatures of any kind, rats, this kind of thing?
Yeah, we always had problems with them, Harry. It was constantly with you. Fleas, yes. I think I mentioned previously the powder that the army used to issue to keep the mice, the lice away. They eventually used to live on it. It didn't do much good. We used to still use it in the hopes that eventually the mice might get wise and say they're supposed to keep you off. But it never did. Lice, no. We were never bothered with lice. Because, again, it was one of those things that we always used to take an opportunity. On some occasions, you would get maybe a couple of lads from each section going out down to the coast and having a wash, you know, and... Again, it was issued with supposed to be salt water soap, which we used to use in the desert. It was never any good. But we used to just go in the sea with our clothes on, and bearing in mind the activity of the air activity, you had to be constantly alert the whole time. But this is one of the reasons possibly why we never got any lice. And we used to get by walking at the sea with all our clothes on, you would get rid of most of the fleas as well. So we were comparatively fleeing till we started all over again, you know, and then... till it was your turn to go down to the coast again, have a bit washing the sea, or a bit splash about. But that was very risky. It was very risky.
Desert rats, did you have any problem there?
Yes, I found one on my chest one night when I was asleep. Very tame things, or very nervous things. They weren't frightened of people so long as there wasn't any sudden movement. harmless. They wouldn't attack you or anything. But this was the only time I ever saw one close up at hand. It'll tell you how nervous they were. Used to keep away from us. They were more frightened of us than we were frightened of them. But they were, I wouldn't say cuddly little things. We weren't afraid of them, but we just didn't like them about. Where they pick the scraps up from, I don't know. I know it's the usual thing, but fellas chucking bits of biscuit out and bits of fat bacon. I suppose they were living on the fat of the land. Well, yes, that was the only encounter I had, one on my chest one night when I woke up. He stopped for a minute, and as soon as I turned over, he off. Oh, he or she, I don't know what it was, never bothered to find out.
Were you dealing yourself as a first aid person with men who were contracting some forms of diseases or illnesses in the desert?
The usual sort of disease. I think I've explained before how we got these desert sores, how we cured them through the boffins and base, you know, with the sulfonamide powder and Vaseline. We still carried out that sort of thing if we found a bloke that had one, because they could develop fairly rapidly. Boils, no scurvy or anything like that. This was a remarkable thing, considering we'd done about 3 months into Brook. There was no such thing as scurvy, anything like that. Now, whether or not this develops over a longer period that we were, you know, away from fresh fruit, I don't know. I don't know the history of it or whatever. But we had very little of that. Dry skin, yes, quite common. You just use olive oil to overcome it. But the biggest bug bought was, again, the desert sores, what we used to call the desert sores. And you know, I never found out to this day what the proper name for them was. And yet we used to treat them quite successfully with the sulfonamide powder and Vaseline.
You mentioned going into the sea and, in effect, washing with your clothing on. Mm-hmm. Did you get much chance to change your uniforms?
Very little. This was one of the things, again, time, experience. It wasn't... I don't suppose we could really find time. You have to have the supplies brought up through, you know, with the destroyers again, because they supplied everything to the guys.